Welcome back, Patriots, to another sizzling episode of Fired Up Conservative Talk. I'm your host, William Del Pilar, and ready to ignite some political fireworks and roast the left's latest shenanigans. First up, we've got some California talk, the Steve Garvey versus Adam Schiff showdown, a battle between a baseball legend and a political pencil pusher. Or is it pencil neck? Who knew C-SPAN could be more entertaining than the World Series? Then we'll take a linguistic journey through Kamala Harris's United Nations of Accents. From Jamaican to Southern drawl, our VP is giving Meryl Streep a run for her money in the accent department. It's almost as if she's trying to appeal to every demographic at once. I mean, it looks like she can be everyone else, but herself. Speaking of Kamala, we'll explore the Democrats' Herculean task of propping up their gaffe-prone nominee. It's like trying to teach a fish to climb a tree. No matter how hard they try, it just keeps flopping around. Next, we'll head to Butler, Pennsylvania, where Trump made a triumphant return after a recent assassination attempt, because nothing says I'm unstoppable like showing up where someone tried to take you out. And finally, we'll wrap up with a spicy question. What does sex and COVID have in common? According to New York City's COVID czar, more than you might think. Stick around for this juicy tidbit that'll have you reaching for hand sanitizer and a cold shower. So buckle up, folks. It's time to get fired up. Everybody, this is William Del Pilar. Once again, this is Fired Up Conservative Talk, and I'm here with our regular panel, Mr. G. Mangani, and a welcome back to Annette Ross after being stuck in New York in the boonies somewhere. It's good to have you too. And I do have a quick announcement. I am, what's the term, guys, when you're self, you notice these. If you guys see me doing this a lot, it's because I have my friendly peppermint essential oil. I've got the AC on and the nose gets stuff. I don't want y'all out there thinking, damn, man, they got a coke addict over there. This is not the 1980s, people. You know. So, Miss Annette, how was it was a semi-family and class reunion you went with our newfound good friend, Bill, your husband?
Yes, he is, and he is entertaining. It was great. You know, it was the East Coast, the beginning of the fall colors, absolutely beautiful. Yes, actually a friend of ours also passed away, so it was like a celebration of life, a reunion, and also grandmother's birthday. So, yes, but it was wonderful to be with family and friends and missed you guys. I hope you guys were okay without me.
Yeah, we had a good time. It was a testosterone-filled event, and you guys never see him, but our producer, Big John, joined the show. You know, that libertarian had to get his two cents in there with the let's legalize drugs. For a man who does not smoke, drink, or has ever done one drug in common, I'm going to start calling him Don Trump Jr., you know. But here he comes on board and starts defending the druggies like his life depended on it. I'm picking on him.
Yeah, that was the moment of last week's show, for sure. And William, so you have the sniffles. Apparently you haven't heard that. Our state has implemented a mask mandate for some counties. So, up in the Bay Area. Can you believe it?
No.
For COVID.
I mean, I
guess COVID's
a
thing again.
Oh man, I got to tell
October
you.
October surprise?
Please no.
And I don't have the sniffles. It's just with the AC on, my nose is eventually going to get stuffed up, you know. And I love my essential oils. I use it for everything.
You're making me very nervous, William.
What's that?
I said you're making me very nervous that you love your essential oils.
That's pretty healthy. I mean, I have everything from essential oils that'll stuff that'll stop bleeding, to headaches, to breathing, through you name it. I look at it this way. Why sit there and pay for all those, for why support Big Pharma when I don't have to? So let's get to it. The first up is going to be a California topic. And for the big record, Big John, I kind of had no choice the way the show's structured. Big John, our producer, is always saying, don't start with California. Make it national. Well, I guess I could tweak it in national because this is a battle to see who controls the Senate. So I asked you guys to take a look at the debate. What were your thoughts on it, G?
Well, obviously, in substance, Steve Garvey just knocked it out of the park. And there were a couple moments where I thought, man, if he was just a little more articulate, if he was a little more polished as a politician. But wait a minute, that's not what we want in D.C. We want someone who's just going to go there and implement common sense. So in terms of being slick, Schiff won the day. But in terms of substance, I believe Steve Garvey won the day. And there was one moment where I was like, oh, man, you got to say this. You got to say this. So when we get to the point, we'll talk about it. But it's like, oh, he finally got to it. It was halfway through his answer. And he finally said, you've been there for so long. Why is the tax code that way, right? So so that was my take on it.
Ms. Annette, what about you?
Yep, I agree with G in terms of authenticity and relatability. I thought Steve Garvey, I love your baseball reference, G. Hit it out of the park.
Not intentional either. That just kind of.
That just can't. No, he. I've never seen him talk publicly. That was really the first time watching that debate. So I wasn't sure what to expect. I thought he was terrific. I liked him right away. I liked the way he dealt with the points. I thought he was calm and measured. But I felt also, which I think is a hard thing to convey, trustworthiness. I felt I could trust him, and he conveyed that. I thought he did a great job. It was a great debate, in my opinion.
I thought, it kind of reminded me of the J.D. Vance Pitt-Wallace debate. It was two gentlemen, but they took their shots at each other. I agree with G from the perspective, a little bit more polished, but at the same time, I like that raw energy he's not an everyday working man. I mean, let's be clear on that. But, you know, he came across to connect with the working man. I'm just not sure if there's enough votes here in California for him. But, you know, I put an article out from the San Diego Union Tribune, which is traditionally leftist rag. And even there, they said he won. You know, obviously for those of you who don't know, Steve Garvey's a former baseball star, should be in the Hall of Fame, but he's not. Y'all may not realize that Steve Garvey was not well liked by the press, you know, and it's those same fools that do all the voting. But when you look at his numbers, they match up with more than a handful of people in the Hall of Fame. But I'm digressing. But he played for the Los Angeles Dodgers, and then he came down and played for the San Diego Padres for a few years, you know, but in his heart, he's a Dodger. You know, so he's portrayed himself as an outsider, focusing on anecdotes that highlighted the failures of this current administration. And there's a lot of anecdotes he could point to in terms of realizing that. I wonder if he has a stroke. He's got that, you know, just that look, you know, he's always looking down. You guys thought he did well enough. How do you think he came across to the public, though? You told us how he came across to you. How do you think he came across to the public, G?
That's hard to know. I kind of thought that there would be – I mean, there was kind of like this – it felt like a little bit of an amateur Reagan, right? Like Reagan had the polish of a Hollywood star, and I was sitting there watching Steve Garvey, and he came across more like the 1986 Reagan, right? A little bit like confused at times. Again, this is stylistically. And there was one time where he just was quiet, right? And Peter Schiff turned to him and said, made him silent, or got his tongue or something like that. And he was trying to score points there. And I was thinking, oh man, what's happening with Steve right now? Is he imploding? And then I think he was just thinking how he wanted to phrase what he wanted to phrase. But, as far as the public, I'm not sure. I think his message is not California's public message. So it just needs to sway enough voters, you know, 10% of voters to vote for him. And I don't know if it will.
You know, Annette, I agree with G. He said all the right things, you know, whether it was the economy. He spoke directly to Latinos. Mm-hmm. He was very snarky in a very polite way that worked, you know, with, there you go again. That was, to me, very Reagan-esque there. I mean, just there you go again. How do you think he came across to the public? To be quite honest, the way our state talks tribalism, I mean, I wonder if a lot of people just saw a rich white guy up there. How do you think the public saw him?
Oh, wow, that's really interesting. I think the reason why, if you just talk about how the public might have perceived him up there, Adam Schiff just seems so unlikable in contrast. Maybe that, do you know what I mean? Even for someone who might like his politics, boy, he seems like an ass. Can I say that online? I don't know. He just seems that way.
You're not allowed to say it, but G is.
Okay. he just comes off that way. So at least, putting aside maybe that people who are Democratic are still going to like where Adam Schiff is on policy, he just seems like a big jerk. And so I thought Steve Garvey, even if he's not as polished and poised and not always super articulate, and he was slow sometimes to answer and thinking about things, I still thought he just seemed authentic. And I actually think people like authentic. I think they like that. And wait, he made a point about, you know, about how he was raised. And about his mother. I mean, do you guys remember that point? It didn't sound to me like he had...
Fill the audience in. Fill the audience in on that point.
Well, he made a point that, I guess, in the past, Adam Schiff was talking about third base or something, and I guess it was a reference to how... I didn't know this. See, again, I watched this. I was like a new person watching this, you know, like a babe in the woods listening to these guys. And so I'm thinking to myself, then he said, hey, my mom, you're insulting my mother. My mother did all these things to raise me. She was a hardworking woman. You know what I mean? She was like taking the bus here and doing this. And so don't make it seem like I grew up with a silver spoon. Like that's not accurate. So
he was defending himself. Yes. No, I agree.
That means he made his own way though. So that's important. That was an important point. I thought that was an important moment for me watching it.
But he is the American dream, you know, in terms of every childhood's dreams of being an astronaut, football player, baseball player, and fireman. And fireman's the only one that's actually attainable for most of us. Gee, what do you think of his economic policy? He criticized the federal deficit under Schiff's watch, referencing the Reagan era line about economic conditions deteriorating. What kind of bugs me when Republicans do that? And I'll give him a pass because he's not a politician. But I'll be honest, what bugs me about that is like, it's not like our Republicans have been these conservative stalwarts financially. So when I saw that, I'm like, that seems like an easy target. But at the end of the day, it sounds to me a little hypocritical from a party perspective. Do you give him a pass because he's an outsider?
Absolutely. He's an outsider, and he's running as a challenger to the incumbent. So the deficit is increasing under both parties. So that's obviously clear. So for either side to say, okay, no, we've got the right policy on this is incorrect. But you know, if we're going to have a deficit, I would rather it be on the side of letting people keep their own money rather than increasing the welfare state or increasing, in this case, we're increasing the welfare state for people who don't even live here. I mean, they're in other countries and we're going to fly you in and give you a credit card and put you up in the hotel. So, you know, we're increasing our deficit by that and as well as increasing inflation. So I thought Peter Schiff was interesting because he acknowledged that people in California are having a tough time right now. And so I don't know if that's helping him or hurting him. I mean, he has to acknowledge it. But here's my question, because then you have Kamala Harris, you have Peter Schiff, and they can't say that we're better off than 4 years ago. And technically we are. Why can't they make the case? technically we are, because we were shut down during COVID and the unemployment rate shot up because no one could go, well, what was it, 8% of people could not go to work. So make the case. Yes, it is tough now, but technically we are better off than 4 years ago. But and then at the same time, they're making the case that they created all these jobs and they were just bounce back jobs. So if they can make that case, which is, you know, not a real good case, then why make the case about, yeah, technically we are better off than 4 years ago, but they won't make that case. This is sound.
Well, they tried. They tried, but it's such a lie. They've tried a couple of times. Even Democrats, I remember when Kamala brought it up once, said, well, 4 years ago we had a COVID shutdown. That's why. So they've abandoned that. So in fact, it's kind of like you're slicing your own throat if you bring that up. But yeah. Let's talk about his, he had no answers in this clip here.
Yeah, Mr. Schiff has these great ideas. And if you look at his website, he's got 13 or 15 of them. The problem is he really doesn't have an answer of how to pay for that. And that's why all these issues lead up to $3 trillion in expense. But never does he have an answer on how to pay for these situations.
Chris.
So, I mean, that goes to what you were talking about. And I thought he was pretty good on those types of points there. And that we've talked about housing a lot here. Housing and local issues. Schiff proposes. Oh God, it's like every time they open their mouth, it's like it's trope the right word when they just keep repeating the same mantras over. It's the same old tropes, you know. Schiff proposing solutions like low income housing credits for housing issues, which Garvey encountered as more of a local than federal issue. And I should have shown the clip afterwards because that's what Garvey was talking about. It's like you're always proposing this stuff, but you never have the money or talking about the money to pay for it. I kind of like Garvey saying it's a local issue. Having been on the planning group, having dealt with this stuff as an advisory to the Board of Supervisors, that's where the taxes come in, the local zoning. There's a good chunk of and I always tell people this is true, 40% of the cost of a house or to build that development or whatever, they're paying all that up front, developers, before they even put a shovel into the ground. So I think Garvey was pretty accurate, but it's the same old tropes. At what point do Californians go pencil neck? We hear that every cycle, or do they even have the capacity? The average Californian.
Are you asking me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I think your second point is right. I want to say something about the economics thing because I wrote this down when Steve was talking about the welfare gap. The wealth gap, and he said it's either between now California, a welfare state, and a wealthy state. I actually thought that was actually really accurate and a really good point. I think people don't really understand these issues all that well, but I tell you what I think that they do grasp is that American dream is slipping away, and people who want to own a home are having a hard time trying to make that happen for themselves. So I think they just go based on that, and it sounds to me like Schiff's answer to that is, we'll just give you something now and we'll make up for it somehow. So again, it's something else that Steve Garvey said. He drove this point a lot when he was saying about more regulation. More regulation is less freedom. You're going to get, no, he said that. And I'm like, okay, you're going to get it from the state and the state's going to provide it. What does that actually mean for you? So I think he was strong on some of these points.
No, I'm not laughing at you, Ned. I'm laughing at the fact when you said, I'm like, there's another old Democrat trope, you know. So they talked about the NRA and firearms. And I guess with all the crime, with all the gangs, with everything going south, you would think Californians would be like, give me my gun, man, you know. But Schiff came out with the same old trope, highlighting his legislative efforts, like a bill against the NRA's immunity. And to the people listening, this is what the left does. They want to take out people who fight for these causes. They don't care. I mean, that's how they win. They try to take you out. And we're going to talk about the baker. You know, that poor old baker keeps going to court in Colorado every other year, you know. And Garvey, I thought, countered with the fact that, hey, you know, the Supreme Court has upheld the NRA's First Amendment rights. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, they also talked, I believe, about the First Amendment rights. So it's all about, like, reducing what rights we have, right? And if I can go back to the housing issue, it's also, again, like, instead of freeing things up, they want to clamp things down, right? They want to hand out more money and get the government more involved to allow people to buy homes. But they're not addressing the root cause. And I talked about this in the previous show. We have, in the last 4 years, 16 million immigrants come in, right? And I don't know what percentage illegal versus legal, right? But I think most of them, of that number, was the legal part. And then we have some portion that is legal. We have 4 million housing shortage. So if you take the 16 million divided by family of four, now you've got 16 million homes that these – or I'm sorry, 4 million homes that these 16 million immigrants have to live in, which is exactly the same number of housing shortage that we have. So what's the solution? It's not, okay, maybe we should restrict people coming in. We don't have room for them. No, it's, okay, well, let's give this credit, that credit, and slosh more money around so housing prices will spike up. And again, here, in terms of the NRA's immunity and supporting the First Amendment rights, like, well, let's restrict. Let's get the government in and restrict. And then what that's going to do is going to lead us down the path of, okay, well, your First Amendment right is not no longer a right. It's a privilege. And we're going to take that away. Just like Elon Musk in England, which doesn't have the First Amendment right to free speech. Once he lands down there, there's basically a warrant out for his arrest because of a tweet that he did maybe 2 months ago. We're heading down this path of, these aren't rights anymore, they're privileges, and your privilege to own a gun is going to depend on whether we agree with you politically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just like this staving off with the government instead of trying to figure out, like, real solutions.
People forget, you know, one of the reasons Japan never considered invading us in World War II, because somebody said, they got lots of guns, boss. it's depressing because people, and most, all these school shooters, all these, the Aurora, Colorado movie, they asked these people, so what made you attack that place? They had a no guns allowed, or was it a free no gun zone? You know, when you have a gun, the bad guy's going to keep walking. And in today's society, I just think it's imperative. And I just don't know how we can get this message out any clearer. Okay. So, I want to, let's talk about Trump here real quick.
Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Trump, Trump. How can you think about one man every day and focus on that when you've got millions of people in California to take care of?
Oops. So, I mean, that was a little collage there. But I thought he was very well. And before we go on, our producer has chimed in. The Japanese general told the emperor, you cannot attack America. There is a gun behind every blade of grass. You know, so that's how important. The Second Amendment was created for tyranny against government. But as a side note, it keeps invaders from invading. But so back to Trump here, though. I thought Garvey handled that very well. It's like you wake up, you know, that's all you think about is Trump. He really made the TDS point out. Your thoughts on that, G?
Yeah. You know, this is California. I think that plays well here to have Trump derangement syndrome and say, okay, Trump and Project 2025 and all that. And I don't know if he got his talking point directly from Kamala Harris or whether he's just taking notes during her debate, but it did seem very polished and rehearsed and practiced, but it's almost like they're not listening. Like Project 2025, that's not a Trump thing, and he's disavowed it. But maybe that plays well here in California. But I think Steve Garvey had a right comeback. He's like, well, can you talk about the people rather than sit here and talk about Trump all the time? Like, okay, dictator on day one. Do you think people are going to say, let me Google that, and then they can fact check that? I mean, this has been brought up for what, nearly 6 months now, dictated on day one, and then find out that it was just a joke that he made.
Right.
I think Peter Schiff, he comes across, and his mannerisms. We didn't really talk about his mannerisms as much as Steve Garvey's unpolished, performance. But Peter Schiff, I mean, he has these bug-eyed kind of – he looks like this.
I'm waiting for a break to tell him. Hey,
I didn't know
Peter was running for Senate. He means Adam Schiff.
You can tell.
Peter
Schiff
is an author. He's an econ guy, and he's also an author.
Yeah, you can tell who's the econ guy right here, right? Because I'm just talking about Peter Schiff, but Adam Schiff. But he just looks like this, like evil, even more conniving version of Richard Nixon to me, and it's like. If you ever watched 24, there was that guy who kind of looked like Richard Nixon.
Yes.
That's what Adam Schiff looks like, that guy. You remember that guy? He was always the bad guy. Yes. He was the president. Then he joined the bad guys at one point.
Yes.
Yeah. So Peter Schiff, for the audience out there, is a libertarian economist. Yeah. Big John has to take that jab into us conservatives there.
He's a perma bear, but he has some good points. But a lot of them don't come true ever.
Okay, so he also did talk, he did frame his stories in that, as you said, brought up the mother, you know, he framed it as connecting with voters through personal stories and at the same time criticizing Schiff's track record. And do you think he's going for the voter sentiment that like, hey, we like that guy? You know, you think he's trying to win it over? And that's kind of the Democrats' name. Hey, like me, you know, don't look at my policies. But do you think that'll work for him?
I do. I mean, I guess he's trying to talk a little bit more because, like you said, maybe he's a little bit not relatable because he's been a really famous baseball player. And so people might just see that. And, like, I'm a real person, too. Like you said, I live the American dream. But you forgot to go back to me and ask me about the previous point, William. Are you forgetting about me these days? You don't want my opinion on everything anymore? Just a couple – I'm giving
really
the softballs, William.
No, go ahead. Remember, you guys want to chime in on the point you want. So go ahead, Ms. Annette. Correct.
No. What was that? No, I'm not correcting you, but wait, now I'm forgetting. What was the point right before he called him Peter instead of Adam? Gee, what was that point? I want to just like comment on that.
Attacking President Trump and the Trump derangement syndrome.
Yeah, okay. Before that, we were talking a little bit about the guns.
And yeah, First and Second Amendment.
Right, First and Second Amendment. And I just want to say, if you stayed with that debate, everyone should have been scared about what he said about the Supreme Court. Why wasn't, in the filibuster, that was so frightening William, I need an expression from you right now because that was...
No, it's because I think that, as G alluded to, some of that stuff, you ask the average person, hey, what's a filibuster? Yeah.
Well, I think they explained it, though. They did a good job, I thought, explaining it. Well, no? You didn't think so?
I'm not arguing
the rights of the minorities.
Ron Meering said it best.
What about the Supreme Court? What he said about the Supreme Court? He admitted what they're going to do. He admitted
it. What did he say? Let the audience know.
He said, hold on. I wrote it down because, you know, we all know I'm fading here in my age. First of all, I just want to say really quickly that I thought also when Steve Garvey said the heartbeat of America, which was California, is now a murmur, that was really great.
Yes, that was a good one.
He said we have a reactionary Supreme Court. That's what he said. So would he say that if the court was mostly Democratic? You know what I'm saying? He said we have a reactionary Supreme Court, and he said the court had to be rebalanced. How is he going to do that? How does he get to rebalance the court? I don't understand. That is a very scary statement to me.
Well, here's the problem.
And to add a little bit, he said packing the court, right? And what happened was Trump packed the court with reactionary judges, which is,
I believe it's in
the Constitution. You can put whoever you want in there.
That's right.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense because a court hears cases. You know, sure, they get to choose which cases, but technically they're reacting to America. You know, hey, here's a court case, we're having an issue. You know, so they're
something that I've learned about the court because I watched the Neil Gorsuch interview where he explained that 40% of the time, those justices all agree. And only like 10%, not even of their cases, make the headlines where there's some, like, difference of opinion that is political and it gets politicized. But they all have a very good relationship and they all respect each other. And 40% of the time, they have a unanimous decision. And a very small percentage of the time, do they have one of these, like, again, politicized disagreements where it makes it look like it's this terribly right-wing reactionary court. Give me a break. That was a complete, like you said, to your point, William, because people don't know. They don't maybe watch Neil Gorsuch interviews like I do. And so they, right? And so they don't have an understanding. And they, you know, he just came out with a book and it's really fascinating. So they just are, they're thinking, oh my gosh, this terrible right-wing court, you know, and that's, again, they take in these sound bites and they believe them. And so that's why he drove those points home about the, I don't know, what is it, the 2025 thing, G? What is it called again?
Project 2025.
Yeah, Project 2025. Yeah. I'll make sure I put that in there. I'll insert that so everyone, yes. You know, the fear factor.
Well, you know, Annette, it's not that they believe them. It's the mainstream media amplifies it. So, for example, where was the moderator when he says, you know, you're for Project 2025? It's not fact checking. It's just the moderator could have gone, well, that's been debunked. Or I guess, I mean, when it's egregious, the fact, I'm okay with a fact check when it's a blatant lie. And that's a blatant lie. But they get away with it and people believe it because the mainstream media amplifies it and says it over and over and over. I mean, let's take this here. I want to show this here on his take on Latinos.
Well, I thought this was good, actually. Yeah.
And the question was, Latino voters don't believe you really care about it. And I think Mr. Schiff said, well, we haven't. And I looked in the camera like I will now and say, when I get back to the U.S. Senate, the Latino community will be my priority and I will fight for them. And if we get that supply side economics in line and get this vibrant economy, the money will go into their pockets and then know who really cares about them.
You know, so I thought that was a missed opportunity. I thought he could have tied his baseball experience with the diverse locker rooms he's been in to where, because you truly are a team. Anybody who's played sports and you're winning, I mean, you're truly a team. You don't care that it's a brother, that it's an Asian, that it's a Latino, it's a white guy. You're like, we're winning. We're a team, you know, and you support each other. I thought that was a missed opportunity. And Latinos are literally, they dominate in baseball in terms of the minorities in that sport. So, but he spoke, that's all. He spoke what a Democrat usually says. The question is I think that will resound off of some Latinos. But I don't know if there's enough of us Latinos out here to give them the votes. Annette, give me your thoughts and then we'll go to G and then we'll close the Senate campaign out here.
Okay, because I wrote down about this too because I thought, well, what shifted was interesting here. Okay. I thought Schiff did a good job with that, laying out the problems. But he had no solutions. He laid out some of their problems. He seemed to understand, like, and Steve Garvey didn't really address. He talked about some individual problems. If you played that clip right before what Steve, or right after what Steve Garvey said, then they went to Adam Schiff. So he laid out the problems better that maybe face the Latino community. He didn't have a single answer for any of them.
No, none. Well, that's typical. Were you, does that surprise you, G? He didn't have an answer for any of it?
No, I don't think he understands. You know, basic economics or how to enrich people, letting them have the opportunities for themselves. And, you know, I get it. California is mostly Hispanic at this point, right? It's like 50.1% or whatnot. But this is really a message for all people, right? Is it not? It is for the Indians out there. It is for the blacks. It's for the whites. It's for everyone. You're going to be more wealthy when we have a freer market rather than when we have a welfare state. And so, you know, again, Steve Harvey wins on the point and, you know, Adam Schiff shows that he doesn't know economics. Now Peter Schiff does.
I was about to correct you. I'm like, oh, he meant that one.
Yeah, right? Again.
So let me show you this last. I think Steve Garvey has the opportunity here to start something. You know, sometimes in war or when a movement happens, the person who starts the movement isn't necessarily the person who ends up making it happen, the movement. And here's my issue with Garvey right now, the dilemma he is in. And for the audience, if you can't see that, shifts right now, there's a 22.6 point difference. Believe it or not, there have been upsets, you know, with this type of, with this type of difference. But I don't know if that's, can he overcome that in 30 days? I would say statistically, no. We'll go with UG, then we'll have Annette close it out.
Look, I mean, he can give it that good Herculean try, but this is California. I mean, this is a deep blue state. Unfortunately, since Reagan did amnesty, it's turned the state irretrievably blue. So someone's got to give it a try. Steve Garvey is giving it a try. I just don't think it's going to be enough.
Well, gee, here's the problem with that, though. Part of the problem with Ted is it's also resources going into a race that can be going elsewhere. So it's a catch 22. So, you know, but you got to start fighting. So I'm okay with it as long as we can make headway and continue that message. I just have no faith in Jessica Patterson, the California Republican chair, to be able to do that. Annette, what's your thought? And say, I mean, you seemed a little distraught there when you saw that poll.
I am distraught. Well, I think if there's extra money, it should be going to my race. Ha, ha, ha. But I just want to say that he said something else that I was really – I thought his last minute, his closing, was emotional and heartfelt and real, that he would step across the party line. He would try to build a consensus. He would work with people. I mean, that is what we need right now. Let's just face it. This isn't working the way – we're just – gridlocked, and everybody knows it, but everyone's afraid to say that they have to sometimes maybe compromise, or they have to work with the other party a little bit to actually get some things accomplished. There are people who disagree with us, and that doesn't make them all wrong. So I liked that he said that. I thought his end was tremendous, a really strong ending, and I thought Adam Schiff was just terrible, boring. Same old just talk, garbly gook, didn't mean anything. Just, you don't remember it. It's not memorable. But yes, you just put that poll up there, and I actually thought it was closer. So I'm wrong to think, I thought he was putting up more of a fight. I'm disappointed to see that.
And you know, I will say about the ending of the debate, Adam Schiff tried to attack Steve Garvey saying, well, I was doing this while you were just signing baseball. It's almost like in this ivory tower elitist, like all he did was hit balls and run around, but I was doing something important. I mean, it was terrible.
So
I thought that was terrible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's a Democrat for you. I mean, that's her lifestyle. It's always condescending, and that's why I'm not liked by people. Man, I attack right back. But Garvey held his own, and unlike me, Garvey and Vance, they did it in an intellectual gentleman style. And I did not see that out of Garvey, because all I knew about Garvey was he's an ex-baseball player, ex-womanizer, you know, played for the Dodgers and Padres. And I'm just stating facts here, people. I'm not taking a shot at him. So to see this man was a bit refreshing. But again, and for Schiff, for Pencil Neck to sit there and take that shot at him in terms of baseball, yeah, that was bad, especially with the fact the Latino base are big baseball fans, you know. Mm-hmm. And we Latinos tend to be more working class, you know. I always jokingly point my Latino relatives to my half Asian brother. See what happens when you work hard, when you study hard. You know? Yes, that's a stereotypical trope, but I do it to family in a joking manner. People, I can do that. Yeah. You know? All right. Any final words on this, G and Annette, and then we'll move on.
I applaud Steve Hart. I'm sorry.
Go.
Yeah. Okay. I applaud Steve Harvey to Garvey for jumping up and going for this. I think we always need someone to do it, and somehow in California, if you want to be a Republican and try to win some kind of major office, you have to be some celebrity. And Steve Garvey is one of the, you know, well-known celebrities in our state. And man, I know he has to double the number of votes he has to get, but I hope he can pull it off.
What the hell is the matter with you, man? Peter Schiff, Steve Harvey? I mean, wow. What's up with that?
Come on, man.
this is a monster drink. This is not anything other than that.
In your drink. Oh, my gosh.
You got some spirits in there, G? Annette, any final words on this?
I agree with G in the sense that the name recognition is really important. G's right. When they're running some of these bigger races, they need that to help maybe carry a few more people. Again, are you sure that poll is right, William?
No, 538 has been known to have some bias the last few years. He's actually a baseball geek, Nate Silverman. Nate Silver. And, but I have followed 538, and they've been as wrong as any other poll. It's like their whole claim to fame was, as I did, except I didn't have ESPN behind me, picking Obama in that whole upcoming of him. He got it right. One of the few people who got it right, and actually it was pre-Obama. There was one election cycle that he got right that most of the prognosticators didn't get right. And to me, it wasn't hard, but he's really drifted. You know, he plays a game. You know, when they attack him, you know, he's part of the leftist machine now. Not the most handsomest of fella, but very smart. All right, let's get moving here. You know what? Before we'll save Miss Kamala for last. Let's do some fun, quick hits here.
Okay. You know?
So first of all, I call this the hypocrisy highlight reel, where progressive rhetoric meets reality check. That said, maybe not the best title. The first one I want to ask y'all about is Trump makes a triumphant return to Butler, Pennsylvania for a rally. Mr. G, what were your thoughts on that? And then Annette, we'll go to you after that.
Man, it was an emotional, I mean, at first it was funny because he turns and says, as I was saying, which is basically leaving off right where the last rally ended, right, with the shooting. But it was emotional because then Trump, while there was some song going, was dancing. And literally, he was dancing on his grave, right? That was supposed to be his grave. That was supposed to be where he was killed. And it was like this visual of overcoming that and surviving that. And I don't know if you saw afterwards, if you watched past the speech, but he had that opera guy sing Hallelujah, which is like the more modern version of that song. And I mean, that was just amazing because that's a very emotional song too, a very spiritual song. And so yeah, it was, I think, like I said, I stole this from Dan Bongino. Snatched off some sound bites, and that's what that was, a bunch of images and sound bites, and then you had Elon Musk jumping up. Some people thought that was a cool picture, but I'm like, that doesn't work for me. I love Elon Musk, but, you know, having him jump around crazy, that's, you know, but some people like that, so, you know, teach their own.
Whatever works. Miss Annette, before we get to you, I want to show what our good friend Mr. G is actually talking about.
Good idea.
Lee, thank you very much, really. And thank you, a very big thank you to Pennsylvania. We love Pennsylvania. And as I was saying...
Oh,
I love that. I love that chart. I love that graph.
Yeah, so that's a reference to G's, I was saying. So, Annette, before we go to you, I was just thinking, you know, Obama's like, you know, he's reading a teleprompter. Why don't they criticize him? You know, because Obama, that's all we ever did was criticize him, as all he ever does is read the teleprompter. And the teleprompter kind of saved Trump in this case when he went to go look at that chart and turned his head. What were your thoughts of this riot? You know, reports were like 15,000 to 16,000. I would wager it's probably on the higher 60,000. The media tends to downplay Trump's numbers at his rallies. And then they'll show pictures of before or after it ends. Like, see, nobody showed up. What were your thoughts on the rally, Annette?
Well, it was triumphant for sure. And I would also say that I, on the rally, I thought to myself, boy, is he good. Because I think he knows what an opportunity that was and how emotionally charged it would be. And it absolutely was. And I think that Trump knows how to utilize those moments in the right way with his fan base. So it's brilliant politics, but it's also real, right? He almost did, right? And so there's a triumphantness to it, and it's emotionally charged.
No, I agree. I mean, real quick. First with you, Annette, how do you think this plays with the campaign? Yeah, I think it's great. I myself think it's great timing. You know, I probably would have waited to a week before the election to have that as a primary news. But I thought it's good timing. It's going to help his campaign in terms of making people remember. Because the media has tried to bury this from denying it was an assassination attempt to just burying it in the news cycles. Your thoughts? Is it going to help his campaign run there, Annette?
100%. Yeah. And the media tried to, the next week, it was like it was over and it never happened. It was like, oh, that's so yesterday's news. Yeah. Almost, no biggie. Yeah. It was fantastic campaign. It was brilliant.
Gee.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it will help. I think there's a lot of sympathy generated for Trump, even from those demographics that traditionally don't support him, right? Because they view him as more of a threat to the working order of the United States. I don't want to say the new world order, but you know, the way things are done here in the United States, and they view Trump as a threat to that. And yeah, I think he will be like a stone thrown into the water again and disrupt things, which I think will be good. Again, in the long term, this country is going to be hopeless with all the corruption and up there. So, but I think this will help Trump because a lot of people look at him and go, this guy's genuine, authentic. And, you know, when we get to the Kamala thing, we'll see she is fake and not authentic. And so for Trump to go back there and dance on his grave like that, absolutely, it was another snapshot, another soundbite to help.
Okay, no, I agree. So let's go to Byron Tanner Cross. He's a Virginia teacher who was reinstated after and awarded $750,000 in a settlement after being fired for refusing to use a student's preferred pronouns. He sued, and Loudoun County seems to be in the national news at least 3 to 4 times a year there, that district. And he claims his First Amendment rights were violated, and the settlement includes a $275,000 for Cross. And of course, the lawyers get the big bulk of it, $300,000, you know, with the remaining amount covering the expenses. Now, when certain things happen and me and Big John, our producer, talk about it, I'm like, I really don't have much to say about it because it's overwhelmingly going to be mainstream media diatribes. And I'm like, we got to wait for a little bit down the road for the truth to come out, for the facts to, you know, emerge. And to me, this is part of the process. They were canceling a lot of people. And I'm like, well, just wait and the truth shall eventually emerge. Gee, your thoughts on this? This isn't even the beginning. It already seems to have started happening. Do you think this is going to become more and more the norm and we're going to settle things out in terms of the nonsense that's happening?
Well, I mean, to me, these are two issues, right? So there's one, the awarding this teacher money for being fired or settling because of that. But he was fired in the first place, right? It's Byron, yeah, it's a male. Fired in the first place for using the wrong pronouns, right? Now, right. I was thinking about this. That must have been intentional. And look, I'm all about treating everyone with respect. You want to be called he, you want to be called she. I don't care if you're man or woman. If that's what you want to be called, we should just call you that. So I think of it as a parent. If my son goes to school and my teacher was calling him my son, who is a boy, who is a he, started calling him she, how would I do things as a parent, right? And how would I view this whole situation? And if that teacher continued to do it over and over and over again, I would be like, what the heck? My son's a boy and you keep calling him a girl. That, I mean, he's going to have a complex over this. So, you know, just as Charlie Munger always said in his Warren Buffett sidekick, always said, invert the argument and see if your viewpoint still stands, right? This is not about transgender or preferred pronouns or whatnot. It's about respect. And at some point, if this teacher is not respecting the kid, maybe they deserve to be fired. And, you know, that's my viewpoint on it.
That's a picture of the guy. So, I mean, obviously this happened during times with masks, were in place. Now he said he didn't do it because of his religious beliefs, you know, which always makes me wonder, what would a religious teacher, if I sat there and said, my pronoun is God, bro, you know, how would they react? What are your thoughts on this, Ms. Annette?
Well, I don't know if I totally agree, but I totally see what you're saying. First of all, I'll say better their district being in the news than ours. Just because love that it's them and not out here. But I guess it'd be like, you know how there's districts out here, William, that have like the furries and they think, no, seriously, right? That they're animals. They wanted.
Yeah, that's what I'm laughing at. The furry.
So
yeah.
if I was a teacher and then they wanted me to refer to the child as a cat, do I suspend my disbelief and do that? I mean, gee, what do you think? I mean, this is an interesting issue, I think, because I get what you're saying, because you're saying, well, what does it matter? Because it's a child, you're going to respect that child. They want to be a cat. You're going to say they're a cat. But then part of you is like, wait a minute. If I say that they're a cat, then all of a sudden, then am I saying that everyone in the classroom refers to them as a cat? I don't know. It's a weird, it's tough for me. This is a tough one for me.
Look. Yeah. Oh, let me interject here real quick. So
sure.
I come from the sports world as Big John. So I went to the Combine Senior Bowl. In my day, I was going to all these events. I was told by an agent and some retired players that when these athletes – their special skill, whatever sport it is discovered, mm-hmm. they're never told no. It's covered up. When you don't tell somebody no, it becomes they all of a sudden think there's nothing they can or can't do in terms of like, no, it's my right. No, it's my right. The only time they say no is to you, you know. So to me, this is just a common sense. Son, you're not a cat. Meow. You know, that's not you. It's and in this case, it was his religious belief, he says, because God made a man and a woman. And I don't look at it from the perspective of God. I mean, you can. I just look at it from science. You're a man or a boy. I'll call you it to piss you off, you know. And then here's the other thing. I would be a sarcastic a-hole. Really? I'm triggered right now, son. So I'm going to call you this. Stop triggering me. I'm going to sue you and your family. I mean, this is going to become a mess one day. What happens is the other side that caves in every time eventually learns how to fight back, and it doesn't solve anything. It just makes a bigger mess. So I'm like, enough of this nonsense, you know? I get it. You know, and the reason I laughed at the furries, the first time I discovered the furries was through a CSI episode, the original CSI, the great CSI. And those are grown-ups who wear costumes, and they're making love, you know, and these orgies and all. And I looked it up and I was like, that's true. So when I saw furries in school, I was like, wow, what are they doing, you know? Meow.
No, in East County, William, it's true. In East County, they wanted a furry, requested there be a litter box there. Okay, well, you know that person can't.
Oh, my God.
No, it happened in East County, California. So are we going to say that that's a necessary thing to have at a school? Like, where does it end, I guess? But I also see Gee's point. We're not going to be able to finish, come to a conclusion in this conversation. But there is a part of it that is nonsensical and is hard to.
Yes.
Yeah.
By nonsensical, you mean nonsense?
Some people are built to be activists, right? This guy is. I think he wanted to prove a point, and whatever his point was about his faith or whatever. But there's a way to get around it. If a boy named Carrie decides he wants to be called she, I would just say Carrie all the time, right? Like, right. If I don't want to call and refer to that person as he or she, I'll just say Carrie, Carrie, Carrie. And I'm using Carrie because he's an endorsed candidate for our local school board. And he sent over a picture of him and his wife, and they printed his wife's picture as a candidate, right, in the mailer. And so we're all getting a good laugh out of that. And he thinks it might increase the vote because, you know, his wife's better looking than him. But, okay. At some point, you look for the loophole and just say, I'm just going to call you by your name, if that's okay, or give me a name to call you by, and let's move on from that, right? That would have been my take as a teacher.
You know what?
You're saying it's not your hill to die on. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, you're just, it's a child, right? So treat that child. Whoa.
Hold on. Look at the Asian culture. Look at the Jewish culture. I always look at cultures that have values, that teach success. And this has nothing to do with racism. This has everything to do with who's successful, who's not, and you want to kind of emulate them. You look at the Asian culture and the Jewish culture. They don't deal with that nonsense. And look at their kids, how they turn out. And I'm talking statistically in the general sense. Every individual is an individual. But see, to me, G, that's where it starts. You know, my mom finally got it. I am a product of my mother in terms of how I view people, how I view life. And my mother being a fundamentalist, she sees a heathen who's going to hell. And I said, and I had a close friend who died, and we were talking about him. And there were some, you know, I'm not going to get into that part, but I told her, I said, Mom, the one thing I learned from you that I truly believed is, and I said, I hated you as a kid because you would tell me, well, I'm not Ken's mother. I'm not Kathy's mother. I'm not Dave's mother. I'm your mother. And this is what's going to happen. And I'd get punished. And their parents would allow them to get away with it. So she taught me the value of how to treat people, how to be a good model citizen. So I think it is important. I think when you allow that to happen, it just opens the door to them being entitled. You know, so G, I'll give you the last word before we move on. We don't want to spend too much time on this.
No, but this is a litigious society, right? So we're talking about a teacher and you're talking about the parents, right? I agree. The parents should.
It extends to the teacher. It extends to, because look, whether we like it or not, we are in a marriage with our schools. Once we became a dual income society, meaning both parents work, the schools became quasi co-parents. I'm okay with that because the kid has to learn social values. The parent, you know, teaches other social, you know, it's, you work together. So I think the teacher has the right to go, we ain't going to deal with that nonsense neither in that sense.
Right. And in the end, that's what happened, right? The court decided that this teacher had a right to do whatever they wanted to do as well. And again, for me, it just goes back to respect. But no, I get, you know, this teacher's viewpoint as well. And look, assuming this teacher was making $60,000 a year. I mean, he's got 13 years of pay up front.
Hold on, Gene. We got to leave this, but I can't let this go. So you talk
about. Well, you still have the last word, but you go ahead.
No. I want you to answer this. Okay. It's like it's not the hill to die on. I get it. You know. So as Annette said, there's a litter box in the corner. Meow, gotta go pee-pee. You're gonna go let that kid go pee-pee in the litter box with a little wee-wee or a little girl who's gonna squat in the litter box? No. You see what I'm talking about? It goes,
Where does it end?
Where's my Batman and Robin meme at? All right, let's move on. Okay. So, I am going to defend FEMA and the LGBTQ crowd here. When I was doing my research on this, and I want to make this a fun thing, this video surfaced. It is from last year. Let's take a listen. Oh, let me hit play.
Sparked a few things in my mind, thinking about preparedness and how you said, you know, LGBTQIA people and people who have been disadvantaged already are struggling. They already have their own things to deal with. So you add a disaster on top of that, it's just compounding on itself.
Okay, that's the FEMA guy talking about, oh, the woe is me, the LGBTQ. Yeah.
I think that is maybe the why of why we're having these discussions, because it isn't being talked about. It isn't being socialized. We're not paying attention to this community. Thank you so much. Maggie.
Thank you. There are a couple of things that are intersecting in my mind here. One of them is the culture of emergency management as an organization, as an industry in the United States specifically, not abroad. This has, and my cat sometimes does this. She gets really loud for me, so you'll have to just allow for the little background. The shift that we're seeing right now is a shift in emergency management from utilitarian principles where everything is designed for the greatest good for the greatest amount of people to disaster equity. But we have to do more, right? And so this topic is intersecting, I think, with a number of other topics where we have to look at policies and understand to what extent they have disadvantaged communities that had less assets, communities that had pre-existing vulnerabilities in accessing disaster-related recovery supports.
Okay, so the conservative world just took off with that. See, they're prioritizing LGBTQ. In their defense, they weren't. They were just having a conversation how the LGBTQ. So I will defend that. Now where I will attack the system is that's how it begins, a conversation. So, I think I've told this tale before, the Japanese perfected the just-in-time system. It's a way of doing business in the 80s, 90s. G's probably very familiar with this, being an econ guy. And then I kind of diverged in a few articles. And then I realized the article started talking about the system in place of how it may be nice to have the just-in-time, but they're not going to make progress in making any changes. And it digressed from that. But what I got out of it is they started talking the bureaucracy. They started talking how the prime ministers would come in with, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. And the bureaucracy that was in place there, which we call the swamp or the deep state here, they would write out the prime minister. They would ignore him. They would do what they want. And this is how it begins. Meaning that guy there on the right, that Mr. FEMA guy there, he's the bureaucracy. 10 years from now, they could be diverting the funds to LGBTQ. When you get this mentality in government where the bureaucracy does what it pleases, that creates chaos. And that's partly the reason our country's headed towards the toilet right now. So I would defend it on the fact they weren't talking about it, but then I will attack it as, this is what they're saying today. It's not going to be implemented, but in 10 years from now, it could be. So what are your thoughts, Annette, when you see a video like that talking about, what was it, disaster equity?
I hated that term. You know, they have this pretty well discussed. You know, I was a visiting scholar for a while at the Hastings Center for Bioethics, and I read a book that they had me read there called Tragic Choices. And the book Tragic Choices is all about what she first described, which was you try to help the most amount of people in those situations. For example, if there's it was a nuclear disaster or something, you know, who gets the protection? Should it be children over the elderly? You know what I'm saying? They do, right. In this book Tragic Choices, it sort of breaks all of that down in the way they were looking at it. And there are a lot of different sort of data that they put into that thinking. And this book is only about, let me see, I was at the Hastings Center probably about 20 years ago. And just in that 20 years time, the conversation has changed so much just because of that one tiny little segment of what they just, when they said about having it be equitable. That was not a part of this book that I read. It was actually a really interesting book, and I think they were just trying to, again, only look at it for how do we, you know, utility, how do we help the most amount of people given any circumstance and situation, not looking at any of the other factors really, except in some of the cases they looked at the youth over people that were older, and that was depending on certain situations, like who would get the oxygen, let's say we were running out of oxygen. They presented all kinds of scenarios. And all of these situations are very nuanced and they're super complex. I'm just saying, my only point here is only to say that in that 20 years since I read that book, and it was a pretty new book at the time, so it came out about 20 years ago, it's a completely different conversation because now we have to look at everything through that lens. I can't.
Oh, you're on mute.
Yeah, I couldn't hear you, William.
I'm sorry.
I was gonna say, damn it.
The reason you see me on mute sometimes is I'm posting the videos online that I present them. So we had some video issues.
You're not listening to me.
No, I'm listening to you. I am. That's what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You were, it was pretty deep because when you said the Hastings, I was like, ooh, you continue the surprises. That's very impressive. So our producer sat there and said that he took a bioethics course once just to say he cheated on his ethics final. That's a polite.
I loved. I was a visiting scholar there. I did all of my research on the areas of medicine and the physician-patient relationship. But there were so many fascinating people there. They always throwing books my way. So that was one of them that I read.
You know, when I first heard him say the FEMA that term, I got aggravated too, because in the military I did a lot of volunteering overseas, and it breaks your heart. You didn't look at skin. I saw this poor little 10-year-old girl. I mean, all us guys were like walking away because we didn't want to see people see us. Our eyes tear up. Her family had walked literally a couple of hundred miles, you know, horse walked, you know, to get help. We were way, way inland. I mean, we were like hours and hours in the jungle, and it was a thing they would do every year. And so all the local Peruvian Indians would come. And then, pretty sure, we never looked at skin color. All we saw was a human being who did not have the life that we had in America. So to hear this equity, I'm like, are you kidding me? I don't care if it's a hillbilly, if it's a black hillbilly, a white hillbilly, or whatever in those North Carolina mountains. All I know is it's a fellow American who needs help. If it's a dog, as a dog lover, I'm risking my life to go say that. That's how... I want to say that's how Americans think, but actually that's how most humans think who have some kind of common sense. So to hear this equity, it's like, and I can picture these people. And when I say these people, these college educated on paper, and they're in their offices or they're in their Washington DC apartment complex, have no clue how the real world works, making these type of decisions and screwing people over. So it does bug the hell out of me, to be quite frank. Even though I'm defending them, it was just a talk. 10 years from now, that's more than a talk. Gee, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, whenever you're on a battlefield, they're going to do some kind of triage, right? They're going to figure out who needs the most, right? And so I don't know if FEMA does that or just whoever shows up for water gets a case of water or whatnot. So I don't even know how this person would even think to implement that. I mean, are they going to go out there and say, who's wearing a rainbow shirt? Who has a rainbow flag? Or, you know, a questionnaire. Okay, do you want water? Well, are you gay? Oh, you're not. Okay, back of the line, buddy. And that leads me to a second point. When you control the language, you control the narrative, right? So when you say something, there's also the third law of thermodynamics. You're also not saying something else. When you're saying we're going to prioritize LGBTQ, then you're also saying we're going to deprioritize straight people.
Bingo.
We're going to deprioritize children. We're going to deprioritize every other group, and we're going to push them to the front of the line or the front of the bus, and everyone to the back of the bus. And that's disturbing. I'm glad it was just talk. But like you said, that's how it starts.
I thought we were getting away from that as a society. I thought that was the whole point.
Where have you been since 2008?
You know, as a Latino. 2008, William, that's when I think I donated to Obama. I'm a Democrat now. I didn't tell you.
Damn you. You're a furry. You are now a furry.
I'm a furry and a Democrat.
Political enemies are going to use that, so you better put a disclaimer that you did not, right?
You know, as a Latino, again, I say this every week. I come from a mixed family. So I have from when they came up with the first hate crimes, or when they started to change the entrance to be a cop, you know, lowering the standards for women, I got so angry. And I was a child at the time. And my anger was because I couldn't understand. Aren't we all equal? Why are they making these changes? I couldn't fathom why they were doing it. And even as an adult, when I figured it out, I was like, well, that's still wrong, you know? And to defend the gay community, in my heart, I know 99% of those gay, if somebody's gay helping in North Carolina somewhere, They don't care if you're not gay. They're going to be the first ones to help. It's always the academics. Excuse me. I don't mean to knock, make you thinking that I'm picking on you. I'm not, you know, it just seems to me in my anecdotal life, you know, and looking at these anecdotally, it seems to always be these ivory tower academics that start this crap. Because it's, I guarantee you, there's a black guy, gay guy, a straight guy, white, but whatever. They see somebody in danger, they're gonna go help them. You know, so it's where are we going? Yeah, where are we going?
That's an optimistic view, and I hope that that's an accurate view. I feel like in other countries we might be better at that than we are.
You know why I know it's accurate, and it'll never happen. I will never push for it because it goes against what our country stands for. But you learn this in the military, and you learn this playing team sports. Because it's about winning, and the military is about surviving. And you work. You have – see, here's the other thing is we you're segregated. You go to the birthday, it'll be the whites. We eat with the whites, blacks with the blacks, Latinos with Latinos. But when you're working together and the bleep hits a fan, I've never seen more people come together than, you know, especially in the Navy. You know, if you don't come together, oh, we're going to sick. We're going to sink. You know, we're going to die. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I don't view it as optimism. I view it as that's human nature. You know, when you see your fellow man, that is if you've been brought up without hate, if you've not been indoctrinated. That's why, as we all agreed on, this is where it starts. All right, guys, I hate to have the last word here, but let's keep moving. unless you guys have to say something that really pertains to it. Let's talk about rhetoric hate. You know, once again, it's the left with the rhetoric hate. I'm sorry. You know, there's talking trash and there's hate. And let me show you what I am talking about to our famous ex-Republican turned rhino turned.
What happened to him? Mika ruined him.
He wanted a peace instead of his values. Let's be honest. You know, I mean, look at him. Let's give some credit to Mika here. Joe's out of he's hitting above his weight there, you know, with her. So here's what I'm talking about.
Is an increasingly desperate person, an increasingly desperate family who's preparing for civil war. They just are. Talking about.
So I stopped it because that was my point. That's the rhetoric. We got a lot of nut jobs out there. We got a lot of uneducated people in the terms of how the real world works. These are the ones who are going to get scared. I'm going to go get a gun. I'm going to shoot. I mean, there are – I mean, look, we have the Menendez brothers, the Jeffrey Dahmer brothers. We have all these – there's some nut jobs out there, people. So that, to me, is a hateful rhetoric. And in my heart, I believe some of these people may say that on purpose to get that hate ginned up. Give me your thoughts, but feel free to correct me too if you think I'm wrong. Let's start with Mr. G here.
No, absolutely. I thought after the attempted assassination on July 13th that there would be this idea that maybe we should tone it down, right? I believe Biden came out with a Oval Office speech. And, you know, again, he misspoke, but he said, we got to resolve things at the battle box. All right. He meant to say ballot box. But no, the rhetoric has just gone right back to where it was. And it's all coming from the left. And it's unfortunate because if anyone on the right had said something like that, it's just pounced upon. So Trump said, if we don't win, there'll be a bloodbath. In the auto market, in the economy, in the car space, and they're saying, oh, he's saying that there's going to be mass shootings and blood in the streets. And it's like, okay, that, I mean, my blood boils when I hear that because they're just taking things out of context. And, I would hope the American people would just Google that. But, yeah, absolutely. It's coming from Joe Scarborough, who used to be, you know, one of the better thinkers, and now I don't know what's happened to him.
Didn't he get his start with DeSantis in Congress at the same time? I can't remember. But Miss Annette, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say that hardly anybody watches him out of the tri-state area. Sorry, but their numbers are no, true. Their numbers are way down. And you're right, G. I mean, he has changed over the years dramatically. I used to watch that show and I really enjoyed it. And then he ends up, you know, having an affair with Mika and marrying her, and all of a sudden he is a raging liberal. Are you kidding me? I did not even know that a change like that was even possible in a human being, but I literally watched it transpire, and as soon as it started happening, and it was completely biased all the time with every single person, Donnie Deutsch on that show, it is a nauseating show to watch now.
Oh, God, I loathe that guy. Yeah.
I loathe him, too. I can't even take it for 2 seconds. I don't watch it anymore, but I do agree that for him to even suggest something like that, it's the same old 2025 garbage, scaring everybody. There's going to be a civil war. And for people who think that Trump is a little rough around the edges, or, you know what I mean, they get scared by that kind of stuff. I know people who went to go see that movie Civil War, and they were like, oh, my gosh, that could happen. That's the kind of thing that will happen if Trump's in office. So some of these fear tactics work. That's all I'm saying.
You know, if I was a Democrat and those words were thrown at me, I'd be like, really, really? Well, what does Lori Klausudis have to say about it, Big Joe? What does Lori have to say? That's the intern that was murdered. You know about. I go, and you're the Putin contact. You're married to a Russian. Mr. Putin content, you know, it's like you just throw it back at him. See, and I think we need to do that more often. But then again, there goes J.D. Vance proving me wrong with his intellectual takedown of Tim Walz, you know. All right. I don't see it ending. I see it getting worse for the simple fact that they're seeing Kamala heading on down the hill in a bad way. All right. Let's move on to Trump. So, Big John, you're more than welcome to pop your head in if you'd like, because Big John has said Joe Rogan will never, never, never interview President Trump. And Joe Rogan said that. But according to Elon Musk has indicated that Joe Rogan will interview former President Donald Trump on his podcast. So this is a free-for-all. You can comment on whatever you want, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on, do you think, and this is why I say, Big John, if you want to jump in. Do you think Joe Rogan's looking at his interviews on Theo Vaughn, who's a big-time comedian? I mean, the guy still wears a mullet, man. You know, it's like, come on, Theo. Theo Vaughn, he's a comedian. He gets some great people. He had Lainey. What's that country singer, Lainey? Remember with Lainey, excuse me hearing that, but when Lainey with the picture had the big tush, the big booty, you know, he got her talking about that. And she's like, man, I just thought a little viral thing, but whatever, it gets him to listen to the music. So he's able to get these people to open up. And he interviewed Trump. Then Andrew Schultz interviewed Trump. And Trump wrote punches taken by Andrew Schultz. I wondered, is Joe Rogan seeing these and go, hey, maybe I should interview him? And then my second part to that question is Joe Rogan's – well, let's do the comedian first. Then I'd like your take. But it's a free-for-all. Comment on it. What do you think about Joe Rogan potentially interviewing Elon Musk? Joe Rogan potentially interviewing President Trump.
Look at you guys tonight.
I know. It's like, woo!
William made the mistake this time.
Yeah. So we'll start with you, Ms. Annette. What do you think?
Do you mean, do I think it's a good idea? Do I think he should do it? What's your, I mean, do I think it's good for Trump?
What are your thoughts? Joe Rogan is the preeminent podcaster in America.
He's number one. I mean, aren't we number two?
No,
just joking.
That's a good one. Oh, I love you. There you go.
What can I say? I think it's great. I love his podcast. I think it'll be great for Trump. I think it'll be great for his show. I think he's got a huge audience. People love Joe Rogan. He does a nice long format. He lets people just talk. He's actually very intelligent. He asks great questions and he listens. So I would be all up for watching that podcast. I think it's fantastic.
You like him long. We know that. Okay.
After what we saw with the ABC and CBS debacle, I think what we just need to get, and this is going to come, and I don't know, I mean, obviously not this cycle, but maybe in the next cycle, we're going to see Joe Rogan moderate a debate on his podcast, right?
I mean, that's going to be the future,
right? Because, I think Joe Rogan will be more fair to both sides because he's libertarian, right? and his leanings. I think he's going to vote for Trump, but I think it would be more fair than the cohorts on the left who pretend to be neutral and fair, but then fact check J.D. Vance and Trump all the time. So, yeah, this is going to help his podcast if he shows up, if Trump shows up on Rogan's podcast. There's Big John.
Yeah, to the audience, Big John plays our producer, but Big John has his own podcast called Free for All, which deals with libertarian topics, and he's our interviewer, has some great interviews on The Big Question with Big John. He's also our – he's also has a – I don't know. There you go. He also has a I forget what the term I would use, but he loves comedy, so he knows all the inside and outs of the comedic world. Big John, what's your take on Joe Rogan possibly interviewing President Trump?
Well, I didn't hear that, to be honest with you. And yeah, up until you just said it, Rogan, every time someone asked him, I know Patrick Bet-David, when he was on there, practically begged them to have Trump on the show. Okay. And he kept saying, everybody who asked him, Eric Weinstein, when he asked him, Musk, I think, asked him during his interview with Rogan. Rogan kept saying, I have no interest in bringing Trump on. I think there's I'll correct G a little bit. Rogan isn't a libertarian. He's if anything, he's a liberal. He describes himself as a liberal. So take that for what it's worth. He always, like, deep down, he always views Trump as a court jester of sorts, and he's always said that. So while he'll agree with him on, you know, the about the media and stuff like that, in general, he has a negative view of Trump. So he always said, I don't want him on my podcast. And there was a podcast where he did reveal that Trump reached out to him and said, I'll come on your podcast, but you have to come. I think it was when he was still president. You have to come to the White House. You got to submit your questions. You got to do this. And Rogan said, I'm not doing any of that. If you want to do an interview, you have to come to my studio. No questions. It'll be a 3-hour podcast. You know, the thing he does with everybody. And Trump refused. So after he got out of the White House, Trump started saying, can I come on? Come on. And I guess maybe Rogan has a little bit of a vindictiveness to him. He said, I'm not interested in helping him. He'll never be on my podcast. Now, did he see the Theo Vaughn? Did he see Andrew Schultz? Now, Theo Vaughn is part of that Rogan universe, not so much Schultz. Schultz is a New York comic. Vaughn, well, he's in Tennessee now.
But hold on, Big John. Schultz is also tight, or not tight, but he's friends and is partly in a little bit their circles crosses with Dave Smith, who's tight with Joe Rogan.
Yes, so you have the New York podcasters, which are Schultz, Dave Smith, Big J. Okerson, and those guys. Then you have the California podcasters, who are now the Austin podcasters once they left California to follow Rogan. And, you know, so Theo Vaughn falls into that Rogan circle. So I'm sure Rogan had no beef with seeing Trump on Theo Vaughn's podcast. The Schultz podcast to me was more interesting. I don't know if you guys saw it or not. Those guys were openly mocking Trump during that thing.
Yeah,
they were trolling him.
I saw. Yeah.
Yeah, they were trolling him. I don't know if Trump was aware of it or not, but I don't know if he was I can't figure Trump out in this case, because even though I don't think much of his intelligence, I do know he's very charming, and he's very during a conversation, people have said, like, he could be very charming, he could be very likable if you talk to him one-on-one.
John, what was he going to do there? I mean, he was in that no-win-lose. Had I been their age, I would have punched him, period. You know, but what's Trump, an 80-year-old man, going to do?
I didn't know.
He rolled with the punches.
Do you think he was aware that he was being trolled by them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was obvious, you know.
It was obvious to me and to you, but I'm saying, do you think Trump realized
it? It was obvious to Trump, but see, you have to understand, Trump's right now in the zone. He doesn't care. Right now, and I'm not defending them, he's just in that Teflon mode. He's going to roll. All Trump cared about was getting on there and talking to that demographic. And that's how he's been building his base up. And to kind of push back a little bit, I agree with you because to me, I've always viewed Joe Rogan, and he said it, he's more of a Bernie type guy. But I think over the years, Dave Smith has really got him to him. And he's leaning, and I'm not saying I like it or not, but I think he's starting to lean more libertarian. And that said, I'm more aligned with John. John didn't have a lot of respect for Rogan. I respect the fact of what he's accomplished, but I've listened to him more and more the last year, and I'm like, bro, you're just not the brightest cat, sharpest tool in the shed, you know? So I've lost a lot of respect for
him. Well, you know what it is? It's his overt tolerance for things that he knows are ridiculous. And I think, a big fault of his. Like, in an effort to be fair, he lets people talk that have no business talking. Like, did you see his interview with, who's the actor? Terrence Howard. Who tried to come on and explain that 1 + 1 does not equal 2. Or that, you know, whatever his wacky math was that, and colors and magnetism and all this funny stuff. And, Rogan actually put up with him for 3 hours. Didn't really criticize him or anything. And he had to bring on a separate time. He brought on, Weinstein to debunk him, right?
With both of them. Guys, he's talking about an episode that went viral on the Rogan show. And people were like, man, first of all, Terrence Howard was like, holy mackerel, this guy's a brain. That's how he came across. But it was a lot of nonsensical stuff. I don't want me and John to dominate this.
That's exactly why I was making the point that I think Joe Rogan would be actually more moderate or more fair to both sides, because he actually is taking the Art Bell approach of interviewing where, oh, there's a big UFO following that comet. Let's spend 3 hours talking about that. And it's non-confrontational because he's just letting the person get their viewpoint across, right? And
for debate purposes, I agree with you 100% for debate purposes, because he had that debate when he had Dempsey on with Tim Pool. Yeah, that's Theo Vaughn. Yeah,
look at that mullet. That's how he looks today. Even more mulleter. I mean, the guy has not left the 80s.
That's how you looked last year, William.
He's hilarious, actually. But I was going to say, if you remember, he had a debate between Dorsey when he was the CEO of Twitter with his legal counsel, an Indian woman, I can't remember her name right now. And rather than attack them directly, because he was criticized for being too soft on them the first go around about censorship, that's how Tim Pool became famous. He brought Tim Pool on to be his attack dog against Dorsey. Because the first time around, he caught so much grief for just letting them spew their nonsense. So I think in some ways he will never – and again, I said never because of his past. I could be wrong, obviously. I didn't think he would interview Trump because Trump would insist on not letting Rogan contradict him at all. Right, and Rogan would have to sit there and listen, and then he would get destroyed by at least half his audience. Because half his audience is going to be MAGA, the other half is going to be liberal. So at least half his audience. And that's why.
Perfect. Yeah. John, you're on a roll, but you segued right into my next question. And real quick.
Sorry.
There may have been something that happened. Like, Bill Maher hates Trump. It turns out Trump took him to court. So I'm like, oh, that's why you hate him. But you segued perfectly into half his audience would be pissed, the other half. Republicans make up 46% of Joe Rogan's audience. Democrats make up 26% of Joe Rogan's audience, with independents making up 28%. So, Big John, I see you're passionate about this, so I'm going to save you for last. Sorry, guys. Okay. I don't mean to bump you. So, Miss Annette, Republicans make up 46% of Rogan's audience, Democrats 26%, independents 28%. If he does interview Trump, and John, Big John, Elon Musk is the one who said this, if you're wondering. So if he does interview President Trump, do you think Trump can sway some of those Democrats and independents at 28 and 26%?
It was interesting, John, that you just said you don't think, or did G say it, that Joe Rogan is very, very intellectual? Is that sort of how you said it? I mean, I think he's very curious and open, which is why I really like him. But anyway, very curious guy.
Defend him. Slap him down.
I mean, if you're like me and you like to learn about people, I mean, he's always very curious about what they're thinking and who they are. And he really gives someone an open So I think it would be, it's going to be really fascinating because we might actually, you know what I think is possible? That we might see a different side of Trump in a conversation that goes on like that for 3 hours. We could learn something, you know what I'm saying? Really organic and interesting things happen when you watch the entirety of one of his podcasts. There's like an evolution, and you get to know somebody.
Do you know what else happens in 3 hours, Annette?
What?
Mistakes.
Okay.
Even Trump, and Trump off script, I can almost guarantee you, his handlers are trembling at that.
They're trembling.
But see, here's the kicker. It's not like Joe Rogan can get deep into economics and things like that, you know?
No, but what I'm saying is, if you let Trump talk for three, because Joe Rogan famously doesn't allow anybody else in his studio. So there wouldn't be a press person there for Trump, or like Sanders was there by himself, right? Gary Johnson, when he was running, was there by himself. Their press people were not in the studio. So if Trump is sitting there for 3 hours, Annette, I agree with you. He could charm the pants off of a lot of those independents who might say, hey, I heard this guy was the devil. He was Satan. And, you know, he comes across like this doddering old 80-year-old grandpa because he's the old man in the race right now, right? But at the same time, 3 hours of him talking with no filter – unedited is a plus, but it's also a minus too. Like, right. He can't have his people go in and say, cut that part out where he said blank, 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 right? Cut that out because that was not flattering to him. So it'll spill out there. Half those people will take those clips and say, he's awesome. The other half will take those clips and say, see, everything we said about him is true. He's a threat to democracy. Listen to what he said, you know, and the joking. Right? He'll come up there and say, I think I should run for third term, don't you? Like he said it. Imagine him saying it to Rogan? Because Rogan will leg him on. Like, hey, what are we thinking? Third term?
I'm going to give a little pushback because you may be right.
Yeah.
But he's learned a lot since 2015. He has evolved. You see it in some – you don't watch him a lot. I don't go out looking for him, but, you know, obviously covering him as conservative. I have seen that maturity in him in terms of he doesn't trip over. He's realized, okay, politics are different. But you're right. I don't know. In 3 hours, he may. But he's learned quite a bit.
He said there should be a national holiday where cops are allowed to do anything they want for one day. That was 2 weeks ago. Yeah, at a rally, he said, I think we should have a national holiday where cops get to do anything they want for one day. And everyone's cheering, yeah. And he's like, that'll knock out.
That would make some massive news. So that
was news. No, and listen, I will say to G, maybe that was a joke. Maybe it was a joke. But my point is, you said he matured. I don't think he matured. You don't change your personality at 80 years old. You know what I mean?
No, it has nothing to do with changing your personality. It has everything to do with understanding what you can or can't say. And real quick, to me, that sounds more along the lines of what G was saying earlier. There's going to be a bloodbath in the automotive industry and economics. G, I'm sorry.
Sorry about that.
No. My point, even before Annette and Big John got onto it, is you guys played right into my point. So let me back up and say Trump is talking, 4 hours a day, right, at these rallies. He goes off the teleprompter. He's going on these podcasts. He's talking at town halls. I mean, that is not all scripted. He's just saying what he does there. And when he makes a mistake, I think people look at that and go, well, he's just being authentic and he made a mistake, right? So it goes to my point that if he goes on these podcasts, let's back up to – end of July, he went to the National Association of Black Journalists, right? And right. He started saying this and that, and that's on the Twitter feed. That's the end of his campaign. He just stepped in it now. And no, he's still chugging along, right? So I think the point that I was thinking about before we went on this segue is that people give Trump credit just for going into hostile territory, right? Mm-hmm. He's going on to these unfriendly interviewers and saying, let's wrangle, let's tackle horns and talk about what really matters. And I think Kamala is not, right? And so she's going on these places like CBS, but they took a black eye for the whole, you know, fact-checking when they weren't supposed to. So that reporter, I can't remember his name, actually gave a pretty good hard interview and Kamala just imploded with their word salads and not answering the questions.
Sure.
And pressed her on those things, right? So much so that they had to go back and edit her answers.
Agreed.
Take answers from a different question and put that forward.
Absolutely horrible. Absolutely horrible what you're describing.
I think if Trump does go for 3 hours and he makes a mistake, people will go, okay, that's not what he really
meant. Well, see, I disagree with you.
Hold on. I don't think Trump would do 3 hours just because of his time schedule right now. I think asking 3 hours is an impossibility for a candidate right now. You guys, if you guys haven't done politics, the 30-day stretch, it's like
– every minute counts.
But he won't. Would not do 3 hours.
Yeah, Rogan wouldn't. If Rogan were to take him, he wouldn't take him for an hour. That's not his show.
But that's what I'm saying. If he's willing to interview him, I think Rogan's not dumb either. He understands the situation. Where I think I'm not saying he would, but I can see Rogan making an exception.
I don't know. He's number one. He doesn't have to. But the thing is, the one thing I will say is you're right. People kind of. When Trump says these things, they kind of brush it off and they go, they give him credit. I think Republicans do that. Democrats aren't going to like him anyway, no matter what he says. And it's the reverse for Harris, right? Harris could come out, do that nonsense on CBS, do her thing where she just cackles at the end of everything to laugh it off without having said anything. I agree with you. Democrats aren't changing their mind about that. Republicans are the ones complaining.
Black men are, you know.
No, but I'm saying, like, the Democrats who are in that column don't view her that way. Republicans.
Hold on, but that wasn't the question. The question was looking at the base of independents.
That's the question.
But hold on. Trump has gained a lot with minority liberals. You can't deny that. He has not gained with that well-off white suburban hoe. And that's why I literally mean
white
like
suburban
that,
hoe.
You know? Whoa,
I didn't realize that was a demographic.
It is. It's a terrible demographic. And I saw that demographic attack my mother growing up. And so when I saw that resurface over the last 10 years, I just loathe those types of women. There's a lot of men I loathe too, but that white suburban woman, boy, they drive me up a wall. So I apologize to any white suburban woman who is not like that, but stay out of my business is how I grew up looking at those people. I'm talking about the Democrats that listen to Joe Rogan aren't those hardcore Democrats set in their ways, because they would not listen to Joe Rogan if they were, because unless they're paid to. So I would disagree with that. So real quick, I don't want to. We got other topics.
I'll jump off.
Hold on. Any final words, Big John, on the independents? So before we close this topic out, let's talk real quick the independents. Big John, we'll go with you last again though. Gee, okay. Independents 28%. Do you think he'll take them? Or switch some of them?
Again, and in the end, it doesn't matter what they say. It's just the courage to go on there and being willing to speak openly. And I think they're looking for Kamala to do that. And every time she goes out there, maybe it's just the Republican in me, but it seems like she crashes and burns because she's, you know, grew up in a middle class family.
Gotcha. And Annette, I was not referring to you as one of those suburban women. Don't think that.
I don't think that.
What's your take? Do you think he can sway any of the 28% of independents?
I think it's possible. I do. I really do. I just think that they'll have a very, very interesting conversation. And I think it'll be because of the way Joe Rogan's show is that people might see different parts about Trump and may get a little more comfortable with him, and he may get out of his like caricature. Do you know what I mean? He's a little bit in a box with some people, and so it might be an opportunity for him to get out of that box.
Right. Big John.
Now you're saying if he were to go on Joe Rogan, that's the question?
Yeah. If he were to go on Joe Rogan, do you think he could sway some of those in that 28%?
Not any significant. I don't think. Like, he would get a certain percentage of them, maybe. And that's if he had a flawless interview, which I could almost guarantee he wouldn't, especially if it went 3 hours. Like, he's bound. Look, on Andrew Schultz's podcast, he said some stuff that was questionable about dating, about his son going out in New York, being a hound, that whole stuff, right?
But you don't get it. He came across great, actually. He came across as human and down to earth.
No, I understand that, but you're asking me about a very specific demographic, right? People who haven't made up their minds, which I'm surprised there's any of those left in this country, right? So if you're talking about that group, that's the one that I don't know if they're going to be find that funny, right? Because those independents might be the ones who insist on pronouns and stuff like that, right? So I would think that it would be maybe a marginal increase, like say of that, what'd you say, 28% independents, maybe he might be able to convince 3%, 5% maybe. If it's a close election, maybe. But I think generally speaking, it would be a negative for him. If he listens to anybody's advice, it would be don't go on Joe Rogan. I would tell him, don't go on Joe Rogan. That would be my advice to him. There's nothing to gain from Rogan. There's only potential danger for Trump on Rogan. He's better off hitting the comedy circuit.
What's that saying about those who take the risk? There's a saying I can't remember.
Yeah. No risk, it, no biscuit.
Yeah, that's another way to say it.
No risk, no reward. Yeah, there's a lot of those. Yeah, so but I mean,
it sounds like the panel's response to you, Big John, is
that I'm wrong. Yeah. All right. Yeah. I get the Batman treatment.
If you get the Batman treatment, it's because we love you.
I get it. On that note, I'll let you guys continue your conservative talk. A very interesting conservative talk.
We're trying to be entertaining. How's it going?
That too. You're doing great.
All right. Okay. Let's move on here. We've been going at this for a little while. We still got a lot more to do, so I'm going to skip over some of these topics and save them for another day.
What are we doing here? I thought we were doing 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we got Big John on there. I had to get his take in. The COVID czar and sex parties while we were quarantined. It has come out recently that Dr. Jay Varma, New York City's former senior health advisor during the COVID-19 pandemic, was telling us to shut up and stay locked up in our homes and we couldn't go anywhere. Well, it turns out that I wish one day I'm going to have the little sound effects. You know, it turns out that Dr. Varma there was chicken down, going to some sex parties with friends, one in August of 2020 and another in November of 2020. One was a dance party with about 200 people. Then adding another one to it, he also had one to a dance party with about 200 people in June 2021, which took place beneath a Wall Street bank. This was all under one of those great undercover videos that show him being exposed. It was just too long. I don't have snippets from it. But hey, I don't fault a brother there for wanting some loving. You know, but at the end of the day, he's telling all of us, shut up, wear your mask, and stay locked indoors. And he's chicken down. I kind of had some issues with that. In response to the scandal, Dr. Varma released a statement claiming he was targeted by an operative for an extremist right-wing organization determined to malign public health officials. Translation, man, they got me talking shit while undercover. It was your classic, when they're having dinner, and they got the little video rolling. That's what he's referring to. Your thoughts, Miss Annette, on chicken down.
Oh, I don't know. Wait, my thoughts that it, so many thoughts there. You mean my thoughts that it happened?
My thoughts
about the hypocrisy of it. Well, I mean, I know there's problems with human beings everywhere, but I really think William, that part of the reason that I don't like about the Democratic Party is I do feel like it's like they try to protect a lot of deviant behavior. I know that really sounds really like biased, I guess maybe, but I do think that. I think the reason why they like want to allow so much, or they want to be so progressive about things, is because they have a lot of like deviant behaviors, and I think that they accept that and they continue on. They continue to protect that in themselves, and I think it's disgraceful. I'm sorry, like this is the kind of thing that I get the most like personally upset by. I do, because I think it's the downfall of our society. Immoral behavior to me is the downfall of the society. Stuff like this, like sex parties and stuff, to me, that's when a society starts to actually show that they're not going to be around much longer. That's my opinion.
No, I can see that. I have myself as an ex-sailor who's done some things you don't talk about.
No, but I'm not. Don't say things like that to me. I was in my 20s.
I was a young, dumb kid. This guy's an older adult, you know? I do have a partial question here for you, whatever comment you want to make on this, but don't you think this kind of undermines the next crisis that they try to lock us up and wear masks? Don't you think New Yorkers are going to go, really? You're going to go down that road, Mr. COVID czar? You know, what are your thoughts?
I mean, like I mentioned earlier, they're doing a mask mandate up in the Bay Area right now. I mean, is anyone going to follow that? But look, don't let another Indian guy with a one letter for his first name malign me, because I know my first name is G and his is J. So, look, there's a reason why one out of six people look like me and Jay Varma in the world. 1.2.
So what do you say? G, J, it's all the same.
Is India hold on.
Annette, are you pissed off because G hasn't invited you to any of his parties?
Yes, I really feel left out. G isn't like you, William. He doesn't have the scandalous past that you have.
Oh, God.
I've had my political opponents look me up, and the worst they could say about me is he's too nice. He's too nice. He can't run the school board because he's too nice.
Okay, on a serious issue, though, G, how does the perception of how people are going to look at something like this in the future?
Yeah, so this happened between April 2020. This is, 14 days to flatten the curve, right? Remember that was Pence's thing. This is during that time, and I believe New York City was having a huge death rate from COVID. And then he's going out there mingling with 200 people. Well, that was 2021, but who knows how many people in 2020. Yeah, mm-hmm. But it was still during COVID, and there was a lot of fear. So what was he not fearing, right? So that does undermine what they tell us, right? Even Fauci came back and said, look, masking during the pandemic, he said, mask, everyone has to mask, it's very effective. Then he came back out and said, well, you know, in the end, it's just N95 masks that really work, and they just protect the wearer. And it's not, I'm not protecting you, and you're protecting, remember that? Like, you don't care about me if you don't wear a mask, right? In the end, Fauci agreed with that. If you want to protect yourself with the N95. But that was after everything reopened. And so Annette and I, and Annette was one of the ones who pushed it to unmask our kids at our school district. And this was in February of 2022. And it was right on the heels of Gavin Newsom saying all the kids have to stay masked. Meanwhile, he goes to the Super Bowl and has his big party with 60,000 people, right? Mm-hmm. And we were all looking at that, and the parents at our school looking at that going, wait, rules for thee and not for me? Like, what's going on here? And I remember Newsom came out and said, well, the teachers' unions are not ready to unmask our kids. The teachers' unions. So there is this political power structure set in place. And who are the victims? It's the public. It's the children, right? In our case, being board members of the school district. So, yeah, absolutely undermines the trust of it. And for Fauci to come out and finally say, no, masking doesn't work unless it's N95, and then it only just protects you. Like, okay. And then now everyone gave up that religion, right? Mask, 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 mask.
All this does is validate for me everything that I was taught as a kid with science and then reading. And it validates for me it was a con job of sorts. Now, don't get me wrong. People did die. But I'm like, these young kids at 90-some-odd, I mean, recovery rate was 90-some-odd percent. And they said, take a vaccine that was rushed through, that people were led to believe you wouldn't catch COVID if you took it. In reality, you did. So to me, right or wrong, doesn't matter. You can argue all you want, meaning to the world. So what were you don't understand this or that. Guys having sex, chicken down, and partying and dancing and freaking off there while we should be, you know, quarantined for our own health so we don't die, you know. It's not, and you know what's terrible? As I say that, I pictured that Matrix movie. Remember when they're all having the orgy there in the Matrix movie with Keanu Reeves when they go back to the city? I'm sort of picturing this doctor there just moving around, moving and grooving, bro, you know, as me and my poor little wife are locked in our homes. Or somebody's paddleboarding in the ocean by themselves, and here comes the police in the boat going in at him, gotta arrest you, you know. I just think of all that while this guy's enjoying life, living large. I think of the Democrat fundraiser here in California where they were all unmasked, but all those brown people, my fellow brethren Latinos, were all messed up serving them. Or I think Gavin Newsom at the French restaurant there, you know. I think of all of that when I see this guy getting on down with his freak, you know. And so that's what I see. So I don't want to belabor the point, but my whole point is this: to me, epitomizes everything that was wrong about how they handled that lockdown, because they knew. And I'm not going to get conspiratorial and say it was this, it was that. I just, like, we need to take a hard look and a lot of investigations, not by the government, but by somebody else. Where's Philip Marlowe when you need him? Miss Annette.
They'll never do that.
No, they never will. Miss Annette.
Francis Collins just came out with a book, and he was, you know, the head of the NIH, and he was working with Fauci at the time. And I actually started reading his book when I was in Connecticut. And really the basis of the book is to say that the things that they really did and the decisions that they made during COVID were legitimate. Now, what's tough about that for me is that Francis Collins, he wrote a book before this book that was all about his faith and all about how he became, you know, a scientist and a researcher and all about his family. It's a really beautiful book. And, you know, he went to map the human genome. So that was, and I actually met him when I was at Northwestern, you know, when I was doing some of the stuff for the Hastings Center. He was there talking, giving talks, really very engaging man, very faithful man, very bright man. Then he's in part of the NIH. He's this, like, to me, figure that's like, wow, I now felt there's somebody that I trust because I've met him. I read his book. I was impressed by him. He was very engaging. He was very accessible, and he's running the NIH now, right? I was like, this is amazing. To me, all of a sudden, I have faith in someone at that high level in an institution. And then when this happened, and I felt like when it was happening, I'm like, no way is Francis Collins going along with this. I've met this guy. This is an amazing person. This is a Christian man. No, seriously, he. And then he writes this book right now that just came out. And I started reading it, and it was all a defense of the decisions that they made during that time. And a defense of Fauci. Actually, in the very beginning of the book, he's thanking Fauci. So I'm like, wow, he's actually doubling down a little bit. No, I'm not done with the book yet. But I always was curious. And if I knew him well enough, I would have actually tried to reach out to him and be like, what is going on with this? So I'm very, I don't know what to think now. I don't know what to think. I'm still really skeptical about all of it. I mean, this was someone, though, that I actually met and believed as a human being. Because I'm not really big on believing in, like, institutions as I am believing in individuals. That's a different... Do you know what I'm saying?
Annette. Here's the problem is, first of all, I'm not saying he falls under this, but power corrupts, and it corrupts absolutely. You get in these power positions, you love it, you're God, you're going to do everything you can to justify bad decisions. The other situation is sometimes you're forced, meaning, bro, you want to keep this job. He's like, I had a family to feed, you got to say this. But the fact he wrote a book to defend it and double down, that to me strikes. I mean, look, I'm a simple guy. But I knew from just studies that a mask was not going to work the way the, you know, airborne viruses travel. You know, it just the holes were way too big in those masks. So, but let's move on there. I just hope, because he did lose his job. Jay lost his job.
You know what?
I'm still gainfully employed.
No,
Was it worth it, Jay? Was it worth it, Jay?
When I think it would be really nice if when I finish the book, I can give you my synopsis of the book when I'm done with it. Just so we can, finish this off.
Man, maybe you can write him if you know him. He can give you a quote saying, yeah, I'm doubling down, woman. Tell him that, you never know, All right, let's move on here. I want to do two more topics before we close the show out, because the other topics, we can hold off on those the next show. They're good enough that where they're carryover. But the first topic here is, and this one we can be brief on because we kind of know the answer, but this is surprising to me to find this many Americans, 67% of Americans support deporting illegal immigrants. The survey revealed that respondents favored mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. This finding reflects ongoing debates about immigration policy and border security. No, this finding does not reflect ongoing debates. This finding tells you what Americans want. How badly does this hurt Kamala with 1 month to go? But I'm not done. Combine this poll with the fact they caught an Afghan terrorist who crossed the border under the Biden-Harris regime of regulations/laws in place, who was planning a terrorist attack on Election Day. So how badly does this hurt Kamala? Or does it? Miss Annette. Then we'll go to G.
Okay, I can make this really simple. You know what I think? I think this is really damaging, and that if she didn't have the abortion issue, she'd be tanked. Because people do care about this. People are upset by this. Yeah, that's the only thing that could possibly be saving her right now, in my opinion.
No argument for me. And you know what? I'm going to add to that, because you're right. They, like I said, that J.D. Vance, that abortion topic was like 15 minutes, and the gun topic was like 5 minutes. And that was purposeful for a reason because of that. But I want to add to, it's not just the abortion, it's the mainstream media. In my heart, I'm not saying that I'm right, but in my heart, I truly believe if we had a fair mainstream media, we will be talking about Trump possibly taking off 50 states, but they prop it up, and our next segment's going to talk about that a little bit. But G, your thoughts on two-thirds.
There was this interview I saw on X, and he was interviewing two immigrants who were here legally because of the CBP app, where you can go from illegal to legal within a minute. And they were holed up in a hotel in New York City, and they're talking about they don't have to work. They're there indefinitely. They got all their needs taken care of. They had a baby, right? And this baby is in a stroller. So you wonder, where is that money coming from? And there's only so much resources that we have as society. So I think that plays into this. Like, okay, I think by and large, Americans believe that, okay, we should be self-supportive as citizens as much as possible. But then if there is some socialization, it should be for those who paid into the system. And now we're paying for those who didn't pay into the system for humanitarian reasons or whatever the case is. But I think people fundamentally say, well, if you're taking resources, that means there's less for us. And we've talked about housing multiple times. So, yeah, this is going to hurt Harris if she keeps saying, can you imagine what that will look like if we deport millions of people? And I think whatever percent here is, I can't imagine what that is, and that would be great. So that's going to hurt her if she keeps going along that line.
G, you are absolutely correct. The only downside is it's the people. Again, I go to these white suburban moms who don't have to deal with the check to check, don't have to deal with the Haitians, or the 60,000 or 20,000 Haitians. It's people who don't have to worry check to check. They're the ones who don't see this. They're the ones who pretend it's not happening. They're the ones who live in the gated communities. Remember, we didn't talk about the crime, meaning the media didn't really talk about the crime being a negative, until those rich, upscale jewelry stores starting to get hit in San Francisco. And then they started to get into it. Then all of a sudden, we got the problem here, people. We got the problem. I agree with that. But I just found it so revealing to 67%, two-thirds of Americans. And I'm like, God bless you people, because I always say it, the airplane, The oxygen mask drops. You got to put it on you first before you think of your kid, or you may not be around to save your kid. Same concept. When our services are being given to others and the taxpayers, the backbone, the taxpayers are going to dwindle and become less and less because people are eventually get tired of the system. And people with money are already leaving this country. You know, and I think in 100 years, the United States could be a shell of themselves if they continue this, because the people who actually can afford it will start leaving, and even the middle class will start looking, because there's always going to be a country that will welcome them. You know, so I think we are going down a negative path. So to see this 2/3 of Americans who do support this, I love it, to be quite honest. And it has nothing to do with hate. It has everything to do with overwhelming our system, you know, taking care of those who pay for it. You know, it breaks my heart if there's an American who's paid his whole – it breaks my heart when an illegal gets $5,000 a month and there's a guy who just gets laid off, you know, and he's got to go to unemployment, gets $250 a week. You know, $500, well, maybe I'm exaggerating, but whatever it is a week. But like you said, the baby stroller. Oh, where'd you get it? Oh, you know, I got this demon. I'm trying to do my Latino impression here. And Demon Marcus, you know? I can do that. I'm Latino. And G, you cracked me up. You're the last person who I think would come with the jokes about being an Indian. I just never pictured that coming from me, you know? I'm sure Jay would be proud if he wasn't crying about being fired.
But, you know, William, I think
I can self-deprecate.
You're saying something that I think is true. I just watched a podcast. It was with Ben Shapiro and Nigel someone. Sorry, I don't know.
Nigel Farage, probably.
You know what he said? He said just what you said. He said, I think we're going to look back, if we could be far into the future and look back at America, we're going to be a blip. This America, this like not the America experiment, but like the America that the founding fathers established, the country that has been the number one, you know, dominant country for this period of time. He's like, it's just about to draw to a close. That was his opinion.
And maybe Big John can correct me, but if I'm correct, we're the only country in the world with the type of government with based off the Constitution that we have. And that was made for the people. And I think with the 17th Amendment, once the senators were no longer representing the states, but the political parties being elected by the people, I think that's when they really exponentially started going downhill. So let's get to the media, because I sat there and brought up the media portion.
You bring that up a lot, actually, William, the media.
Well, I'm a broken record, but when you come from a country where it's the government controls the media, and you see a lot of the government controlling the media in Panama and how the dictators used it, and you see that happening here, you start to worry. And here is my proof. 60 Minutes. And, you know, before we get into the discussion, let's just watch. Yeah.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
Well, Bill, the work that we have done has resulted in a number of movements in that region by Israel that were very much prompted by or a result of many things, including our advocacy for what needs to happen in the region.
But it seems that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not listening.
We are not going to stop pursuing what is necessary for the United States to be clear about where we stand on the need for this war to end.
Okay. I'm sorry. I want to go first here. Sorry, guys. So we saw not quite a word salad, but close to a word salad with her first answer. She was nervous. You saw her voice trembled a little bit there in one sentence. She was obviously unsure, measuring her words so she wouldn't screw up, but going so slow, the tortoise would have beaten her in a race. And she wasn't presidential. When you look at your president, especially I can speak for Latinos, we want our president to be presidential. We want to be like, oh, that's our guy there, you know? And she had no confidence. Then the edited one, the answer they put in, that was presidential. That was confident. That was like, I am woman. Hear me roar. Rattle, in a positive way. You know, it was everything you want out of your candidate. That is what I call the fake news media. That is what I call election interference, because they are showing a different person than what was actually seen. That is the corruption of the media that I have seen firsthand subjugate people and keep people subjugated, because the government is sending a message that is an untruth. That is what that 60 Minutes clip there shows me. With that, your thoughts, G, on it?
Well, let's be clear. So they did the promo of the actual answer, right? Not the edited answer. They did a promo of that. That's how we know what the actual answer was, right? And at some point, they realized, no, wait, this doesn't look good. And they're getting hammered on social media about this. So let's give the edited answer. And how do they get away with that, right? Because they already publicized what the real answer was. And so any free-thinking person will go, well, how often do they do this? CBS, CNN, right? Dana Bash interviewed Kamala Harris, and that interview went for 42 minutes. They aired 18 minutes of it. And even the 18 minutes were supposed to be the best minutes of the 42, and they were bad. So I wonder how bad the other minutes were, right? So it's terrible. I don't know how many people get on X or social media and try to look up the truth. I think there's a lot of people who just see CBS and go, oh, wow, she seems strong and presidential, and that's not what she was.
You're right, G. But we don't know how big this story got. I know I've seen it on Facebook. I've seen it on other social media platforms, YouTube, Rumble. But that said, Annette, I look at this, and then you combine that with what's still on people's minds, the CBS VP debate of how the moderators were favoring it. There was no disguising that. The ABC debate with David Muir. So to me, this audience is growing in terms of like, damn, maybe the conservatives weren't lying there, you know? As John pointed out with Joe Rogan, a big chunk of the voters aren't going to care, because they don't care that they're being crapped on. You know, it's all Democrat, Democrat, Democrat. But there's those independents and there's those blue collar Democrats who are going, what the hell? Your thoughts on this?
I don't think she's had a very good week. She feels to me like she just feels to me like she's spiraling a little bit. You know what I mean? Like how my daughters get when they're tired.
You know? Oh my gosh. Cracking on your daughters. How dare you?
No, I mean, you know, I'm just trying to be more entertaining.
I think Natalie just threw her phone across the room.
I know.
She's going, I'm not voting for her.
I'm just, what's bothering me, and I know you do talk about the media a lot, and you said, and you make a really good point, because of where you came from and what you experienced, you know what can happen, and you know, like you just said, people can be subjugated because of it, and that is my greatest fear of all. But when I see something like that, I'm in shock. Why isn't that illegal? Again, they're not showing the real person. They're propping them up. They're twisting it. They're changing it. They're putting out somebody else, something that's like contrived, something that's fake and phony, and that's supposed to be something that they're going to sell to us, and we have to just take it. I don't get it. I don't even know. I don't know how they get away with it. I thought 60 Minutes of all news media had a higher standard.
Oh God, that standard ended in the 1990s. My personal experience. Oh, and real quick, our producer's correcting, and he is correct. In my notes, I had 67% because I did see one poll. And then when I went back to go look at the 2/3, I found 55%. So numbers are maybe ambiguous in terms of how much, but it's more than 50%, people. So back to this, though. What I saw, I've been a political junkie my whole life. And what I saw after 2000, I saw the media unmask themselves. Because here's something else. People forget. They tried to steal that election through Florida. Al Gore, I've said it before in this podcast, Al Gore cherry-picked what counties he challenged that were heavily Democrat. You saw people, and this is all on video, you saw these people looking at these chads. Well, they didn't vote for the president here, but they voted for this Democrat and this Democrat, so they probably meant to vote for the president. No, so they tried to steal an election, and in 2000, because I was watching both CNN and MSNBC still, a couple years later, I couldn't stomach it. The media unmasked themselves, and it's exponentially gotten worse. I also think that maybe there's some older people who aren't on social media as much that don't realize, yeah, there's some smart people watching and looking for this type of stuff, and they found it here with this 60 Minutes. To me, I get so angry, and it's not because of a hate for Republicans or Democrats or a love for either one. To me, I get angry because the media is supposed to be our defender. They're supposed to be there watching out for us. And they haven't since 2000. And Big John, our producer, he opened my eyes. I'll never forget. I see, I remember little things in life. I remember him telling me about Walter Cronkite. William, Walter Cronkite was actually a leftist, you know, hardcore, this and that. And I'm bad, Big John, you're right. Not Walter Cronkite, who I sat and watched the news with, who my father, the few times we bonded. Not Walter. Sure enough, I'm researching, sure enough. Damn, Walter was a freaking leftist, you know, and it would come out just a few times, you know. So the media has always been kind of distorted then, but it was, they kind of kept it in check. And after 2000, the floodgates opened. So my anger, my distraught is they're supposed to represent us. They're supposed to protect us from both, from the George Bushes of the world. 6 months after we invaded Iraq, I was like, and I'm a super patriotic, whole family military. I'm like, why are we in there? Or Afghanistan. Why 20 years? It's like, oh my God, this military industrial complex, it's true. So I have become so anti-war, not because I don't believe in freedom and helping other countries. It's because it's not about that anymore. So I see the media as the spearhead for the swamp, the shadow people behind calling themselves, whatever you want to call it. But it's clear as day that they favor the progressive side, and all that's doing is destroy. To me, that's what keeps Latinos and blacks on what I call the Democrat plantation because of the indoctrination. We see the news, we believe it. My mother sees the news and she believes it. And she's a simple woman, you know, but she's a vote. You know, so that I started to sound long-winded. I get like this every time we talk about it because it's a passion, because once we lose the media, our path towards destruction exponentially increases. So real quick, Annette, your point on, she's had a bad week. So we left out a whole bunch of stories we're going to pick up on next week. And I called it The Saboteur's Playbook, A Candidate's Guide to Self-Destruction, because you are absolutely correct. She has had, I just pulled this one out of that list because, you know, 60 Minutes is trending now. But so, my final question before we close this out, and bear with me, the implications of this, I've kind of said a lot of it, but the implications, perceived media bias, a backfiring, people are like, well, busted, a confirmation of the media bias. If this is ammunition, like I'm doing it, it validates my belief. Competency concerns, you see this, then you see what they edited, you're like, damn, that woman doesn't know squat. You know, so it kind of backfires. Transparency. The media is supposed to be transparent. They're not. And the double standards, 90-some-odd% negative coverage of Trump, they're just flat out lying to support and prop Kamala up. Out of everything I said, I know our producer, it says, it's not about you, William. And it's not, because I'm reading these notes. Out of everything I said, is there anything I'm wrong? Because I believe all this, what I just said. Is there anything there, William, you're barking up the wrong tree? Or how do you see it similarly? And we'll close it out with Annette. So, G, you head on out here. You first.
Yeah, I think there's a change in strategy for Harris, right? And I think there's a lot of panic on their side. So they're telling her, change things up. And people who are winning, teams that are winning, right? You guys do a football podcast too. Teams that are winning, they don't change their strategy, right? They might tweak it, but they don't fully change it. She changed her strategy. She's like, I need to get out there, find some friendly media venues and get known, right? And then she comes out, and I don't know why she thinks, I know this is one of the topics we have to punt on, but why she thinks coming on and adopting an accent works. Like, COVID, you know, did you get COVID to the Latins? Like, what the heck are you doing? Like, when she goes to, and this would be an honest accent, when you go to a group of Indian voters, they're going to be like, did you get COVID? Vote for me. Like, what the heck? I think that insults people. I think people get upset because it's like, okay, respect and celebrate my culture. Don't mock it. And I think that's, I hope, with the Univision one, came across as mocking. So their new strategy, I think, is backfiring. You know, again, it's just going to move the needle a minute hand over to the right. But they're trying to shake things up.
And for the record, and then before you respond, that was going to be a topic this week, but it's for next week. And I've got clips of every accent. Yeah. You know? So I'm actually looking forward to that one. I didn't want to shortchange it. You know, Miss Annette, your thoughts?
That will be very amusing when it happens. I look forward to seeing more of that again, too. I mean, as my girls would say, sorry, but I have five of them, you know, it's cringy right now. She's cringeworthy. I mean, it's almost uncomfortable to watch some of these conversations that she's having. And she's getting out there more. And, like, I think, Gee, you made a really good point. I mean, if they thought her previous strategy was working, then they wouldn't be trying something new. And they're trying something new because they're seeing that the more she's out there, the less people like her. So I think that has been another very true thing. So I think they're really feeling a little panicked at the moment. And I think Trump has actually got a little bit of momentum on her, which I'm really excited about.
Right. Many are panicking. They believe she's plateaued. And with that topic, we shall close the show out. It's a big hearty welcome back to Miss Annette Ross
and her takes with
the chicka down down. And Gee, it's always good to have you. And to all the furries,
meow.
So to everybody, do not forget. You can we've been at it too long. I'm starting to lose it. So to everybody out there, do not forget you can find this podcast. But more importantly, before I say that, make sure you like, share, and you subscribe to this channel. But you can find this podcast and others like it at grumbleaksmedia.com, as well as our social media outlets such as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Pandora, and Spotify. That's my Kamala Harris there. So for Annette, G, and myself, I am William Del Pilar. This has been Fired Up. And until next week, we bid you adieu.